it's robust. Like a lot of the inspirational things you see, it's kind of a motivational video. Somebody yells at you. There's a picture of a lion and you feel strong for a moment and then it goes away. But this kind of ambition that's founded on genuine conviction about this as being the best way to live.
Welcome to Stoa Conversations. My name is Caleb Ontiveros.
And I'm Michael Trombley.
And for this conversation, we're going to be talking about ambition.
Cool. So, I mean, anybody who's studied Stoicism or started to practice this, I think has felt a typical kind of issue with ambition or effort. So I think one of two things starts to happen once you start learning more about Stoicism, which is one is you either don't question your ambition, you don't kind of question why you want the things you want, and then Stoicism can become just a mechanism to help you achieve those things. We see that in kind of this idea of, you know, the kind of Stoicism for business or something like this. It's the person is just adding tools like the dichotomy of control or premeditatio malorum onto what they already value. I think that's a bad thing. But another thing that's a bad thing that happens is people sometimes lose motivation. They lose ambition. They start to question, why did I want the things I wanted at all? Those things they seem temporary or vain or unimportant once I've started dedicating myself to a life of philosophy. So there's this fork in the road and you don't want to go down either path. And I want to see today if we can talk about how you might resolve it and what a Stoic ambition might look like. And I came across, when I was doing research for this episode, I came across a Reddit quote. It's just somebody who posted this in Reddit, I think maybe like around five years ago, just asking for help. But I think they did such a good job summarizing that this conundrum. And so this is from Sisyphean Effort. And it's quite a long quote, but it's really well written and worth saying in full. And so they say, years ago, I came to Stoicism in much of the same fashion as many of you, introduced to the works of Marcus Aurelius, Seneca, and Epictetus. A lot of what I read resonated with me, but since then, I have experienced what I describe as a distinct lack of ambition / focus that I can trace back to my Stoic readings, the Meditations in particular. So what is the problem? Well, my reading of the Meditations has impressed a few things upon me that have had the net result of withering my worldly ambition down to nothing. Firstly, Marcus constantly references the ultimate folly of considering human things as great, given their insignificance of both time and scale when compared to the universe. I remember him specifically mocking Alexander the Great, as how could one be great when all they've done is conquered a bit of land on a celestial speck? If conquering most of the known world is a laughable endeavor, what can I possibly achieve of any note? Next is the general undercurrent of disdain I detect towards people who clamber over themselves for positions, titles, offices, and material things. So now in my work, all I see is people scheming, plotting, straining towards more titles, more positions, more money, and my perception has been skewed to see these things as inherently worthless. However, the organization expects you to prize these things, and going contrary to these expectations does you no favors. So my question is, what have I got wrong here? Do all the Stoics out there busting your tails, working overtime, and flattering your bosses to gain position and money, how do you reconcile that with your Stoic principles? So that's the end of the quote. And I think that's just such a perfect, it's a perfect summary of what happens when we come to Stoicism and we encounter, you know, one emperor, Marcus Aurelius, mocking Alexander the Great for his ambition being worthless. And you say, well, what's the point of me, you know, working hard for that promotion in my job if Alexander the Great was a fool? But what do you think of that, Caleb? Any thoughts on that quote?
Yeah, it's a great way of setting out the issues. I suppose you could say one way to sort of boil it down into those two points is just that one common Stoic practice is the view from above. You see Marcus Aurelius doing that over and over again, reminding himself of the scale of things, the temporary nature of things. You know, one line that comes to mind is that Alexander the Great and his donkey driver, his servant, they end up in the same place at the end. Hmm. You know, so what's the point when it's so temporary? Is the mental move there? That's that one thought, and then of course there's that other strain which is seeing the silliness of so much human competition, so much striving after externals. And, you know, there's that question that was put well, you know, how do you make sense of, you know, where's the value? What's the worth? What's the point of all this? Which I think is one kind of risk, one obstacle many of us encounter. I mean, it must be a question you ask yourself, Stoic or not. And then Stoicism, in some ways, makes it worse because it gives you some of these tools or techniques, perhaps, that really force the question. And there's some benefit, but also some challenge in that.
Well, I think that's there in the last part of this post, which is where he says, to all you Stoics out there busting your tails, working overtime, and flattering your bosses, how do you reconcile that with your Stoic principles? I think there's almost a challenge there, right? Which is this idea of, because there's two ways you could go. You know, you could take that view from above and say it's trivial or not important and I shouldn't be doing this. You could lose motivation. Or there's that challenge where it's just like, are you really being Stoic if you're doing that? Can you prove to me, can you still be Stoic and work overtime and flatter your boss? Or are you just pretending to be Stoic? There's almost a challenge there. You know, is that reconciliation possible?
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to try to make the reconciliation possible. I want to do that because I think it's true. I think it's accurate. And I think that, as we'll see for reasons, I think a life with ambition is better than a life without ambition. And so that's what we'll get into today. And so I wanted to start off first with just what is ambition, because I think, like any good philosophers, we need to start with definitions. We need to be very clear what we're talking about. So what is ambition? Well, one thing you could do is you could turn to the Stoics, and I did a quick Google search for Marcus Aurelius and ambition, well, Stoicism and ambition, and I came up with this quote where Marcus Aurelius seems to really criticize ambition. And this is Meditations, Book 6, Chapter 51. And Marcus says, "Ambition means tying your well-being to what other people say or do. Self-indulgence means tying it to what happens to you. Sanity means tying it to your own actions." And I think you get there this really clear criticism, seems at least, of ambition. You know, ambition is caring about what other people think, or you know, you're caring about the world of other people. Self-indulgence is caring about what happens to you, focusing on yourself. So, you know, ambition is focusing on others, self-indulgence is focusing on yourself, and then sanity, the correct route, is focusing on, again, yourself, but just the things that are up to you. So I guess that self-indulgence is the things that are not up to you, but yourself. And this seems like a pretty negative view on ambition, but it's also a good lesson about English translations. So I went to the Greek here, and the word being translated as ambition is philodoxos, which is, phil is the love, and then doxa is opinion. So it's to mean opinion loving. It's the philodoxos. I love opinion. So you get that Greek, the doxa, you get that other places, like orthodox means you have got the right opinion. Heterodox means you got the wrong opinion. So if you're the philodoxos, that's somebody who just, you know, you care what other people think. And the second word is philhedonos, which is so what he translates as self-indulgence is philhedonos. Hedon is pleasure. It's hedonism. So it's not self-indulgence, but it's a lover of pleasure. And when you retranslate that, it's, you know, people that love opinion tie their well-being to what other people say or do. People that love pleasure tie their well-being to the things that happen to them. And sanity means tying your well-being to your own actions. And that's an entirely sensical quote. But it doesn't really talk about ambition, or not what I think of as ambition. I think there's something else, because I don't think of ambition as opinion loving.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the Oxford Dictionary again on Google. I didn't have to pull it out. And it's Oxford Dictionary says ambition is a strong desire to do or to achieve something, typically something requiring determination or hard work. And to me, this is still Stoic. So opinion loving, obviously, that could never be Stoic. But to desire to do something difficult, to desire to do something that requires hard work, if you think of ambition that way, then for me, Stoic ambition is still totally on the table. And then there just becomes a good and bad kind of ambition, depending on what you desire. Does the thing that you desire that requires hard work, is that something worth doing or not? What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's one, it's a good lesson in translation. So that was, I think that was really cool and useful to have you bring that out. I guess one point is, you know, we're talking about desire here. In the past, we've talked about Epictetus and desire, and Epictetus uses the term in a technical sense where, you know, desire is pretty close to what Marcus Aurelius is getting at with this quote. It's, you know, tying your well-being in a really deep way, telling your sense of happiness to something, as opposed to what he might call strong desire in the usual English meaning would be maybe a powerful inclination or something of that sort. Mm-hmm. Which is one clarification, but also sort of centers the question, you know, like how strong of a desire are we talking about? You know, some people who are exceptionally ambitious, they sort of, you know, they burn the boats. They want to succeed at any cost, or at least nearly any cost, is the extreme view or extreme position, I suppose. Whereas others might have a less powerful drive. So I guess there is that question that I think is interesting to explore.
Yeah, that question of how much desire are we allowed? Because we talk about that all the time. That's one thing. We talk about all the time about how we can care about things as Stoics, but where does that line get crossed? And where does it cross against, I guess, from caring to ambition? Because what we're doing here, like, I mean, we're doing just a bit of like philosophy, right? Like there has to be a bit of just figuring out what ambition means. And what I was understanding you to be saying, Caleb, was, you know, yeah, I can want certain things. I can prefer certain things. That's definitely on the table. But how much can you desire those things? How far can you go while still being Stoic if those things are not up to you? Is a crucial question here.
Right, right, exactly. I think we'll get into that during this conversation. So I guess the main place to start, or perhaps to move to, is what's the picture where things clearly go wrong? You know, where's the examples of strong desires that are mistakes, are not the Stoic cannot have insofar as they want to remain Stoic?
Yeah, great. So I think, so, you know, we want to say that the Stoic is allowed to want to do hard things, right? So then they need to want the right kind of thing for ambition to be good, and they need to want, if they want the wrong kind of thing, they desire the wrong kind of thing, then that ambition is bad, is an argument that I'm making. So what would bad ambition look like? And for me, bad ambition, I think, is when your desire gets tied up in external things. And not just you want these external things. And I think the difference when we cross over into that unhealthy level of ambition, so not from just like, I prefer to go a certain way, this is something that I'm inclined towards, but actually ambition, I think, is when your identity gets tied up into it. And that goes back to that Marcus Aurelius quote, right? Of when you tie your well-being to something. And I think we tie our well-being to something, and this is an Epictetus argument at least, we tie our well-being to something when we view it as being essential to us or a necessary part of us or our happiness. And so one of the distinctions I want to make here is we can talk about desiring external things and without getting there. So I could say I desire a tasty treat. I can desire to go to the movies. And again, we can parse that language depending on technical or being, maybe that's an impulse, a strong inclination to do those things. But I would not say I have an ambition for those things. But we can have an ambition to become a famous actor, to become a successful business person, to be, you know, a popular We have ambition, I think, when we strive to become something, or at least that's one type of ambition or one type of way that our desire becomes ambition in a way that's dangerous. So we want to become something, not just have something. Because I think when you, because I think I come back to this identity argument a lot, but I think when you tie your identity up in something, then your happiness necessarily follows, right? It's kind of this teleological argument. I am this kind of thing. So if I do well, you know, I'm this kind of person, I'm a business person. So if my business goes well, I'm a good person. If my business goes poorly, I'm a bad person because I am a business person. It's like when you associate it with your identity, you tie it into kind of your purpose, your function, your end. And that's when I think ambition or this desire for external things turns into that bad kind of ambition. And I'll try to make the argument here that the Stoics think the same thing. I'll start with one quote from Epictetus of an example of this, at least as one kind of bad ambition. And so Epictetus here says, quote, "The following assertions don't form a coherent argument. I'm richer than you, therefore I'm better than you. Or I'm more eloquent than you, therefore I'm better than you. No, it is these that make a coherent argument. I'm richer than you, therefore my possessions are superior to yours. Or I'm more eloquent than you, therefore my way of speaking is superior to yours. But you yourself are neither your possessions nor your way of speaking." And that's Epictetus's point about how, again, our identity is our prohairesis, our capacity for choosing, our character. It's not our possessions. It's not our, you know, how verbose we are, how kind of intellectually impressive we are. And I think Epictetus there is pointing at this tendency for people to make that jump from thinking, well, I'm rich, therefore I have more than you. That's totally fine. I have more money than you. That's what that means. To I'm rich, therefore I'm better than you. And he's trying to shut down that kind of thinking in people. And I think that's the kind of thinking that is the dangerous. That is when your ambition becomes dangerous, when your ambition becomes unstoic. What do you think, Caleb?
Yeah, it's interesting because if you think about, there are some identities that you take when you perform roles that are, in general, good things for the Stoics. You know, if you want to be, maybe you don't want to be a famous actor, but you want to be an excellent actor, and that's the role that has to do with your vocation. And most people, it's, you know, very important for them to be good at their vocation. So then, you know, I suppose there's that question, where does the object of ambition turn into something less than ideal? Is it with, or is it not so much the object wanting to be an excellent actor, but the level of desire that comes with that ambition in certain cases where, you know, of course it's important to be good at your job, but you shouldn't trade that off against some other roles you have, some other virtues, by any means.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. I mean, I think it can be two at the same time. So one point, it's kind of boring, but it's just always the case. You know, I didn't write, when I was thinking about this before, I didn't write good actor, I wrote famous actor. And I think that because it's implicitly the famous actor is something that's not up to you, right? Mm-hmm. Where the good actor is presumably more up to you. It's about mastering your craft, whereas the famous actor is about achieving kind of a social status or position that is correlated with but not caused by your skill as an actor. So I think there's something there about, it's the really simple Stoic Epictetus line of, is it up to you or is it not? Good actor is up to you, famous actor is not. And I think you make a good point about, you know, is there something to be said about ambition, bad ambition being actually the not taking on that role? There's nothing wrong with taking on the role of wanting to be a famous actor, but it's when that role, because when we talked about this a lot, in role ethics, there's a kind of a hierarchy of roles. So you have your role as a human being, and then you have some roles that you've born into, you know, maybe you're a son or a daughter, and then you have roles that you acquire or choose to take on, like you want to be an actor, for example. And maybe ambition is when this order gets mixed up a bit. Mm-hmm. So insofar as the good actor doesn't compromise with being the good son or good, you know, father or mother, then it's fine, or a good person. But once the order starts to get mixed up a bit, then you've crossed the line. That's what is that what you were saying?
Yeah, exactly. I suppose you've become too attached to your identity and forgotten that there is a hierarchy between these different roles. Yeah, so that's great. That's one way in which ambition goes awry. Maybe you start with a fine ambition to be an excellent actor, but then become too attached to those things that correlate with being an excellent actor, those proxies, whether that's fame or riches or pleasure that it comes along with. You know, so is evidence that you're a good actor, of course, that you're socially rewarded, but it's just that. It's not what you're ultimately seeking.
Yeah, and I think we can see that in like media representations of ambition or just plays about it, like representations of ambition. There's that kind of trope in films of the person who become, you know, starts off at the bottom and raises and kind of has that fall from grace or that kind of Icarus moment. And I think we treat it as a tragedy, but we don't look up to the people who become attached to those proxies, the actor who becomes in love with being famous, and that mm-hmm. causes them to kind of burn the bridges with their relationships, causes them to not be as good of a family member as they could have been. We have sympathy and look at it as a tragedy. We don't admire it. But then I think of somebody like the painter or, you know, the tortured artist paradigm, where this person never becomes attached to the external thing, always stays attached to the craft, but in being just subsumed by that, actually kind of becomes, still gives up their other roles. I think in that, I'm kind of going off the notes here, but I think in that example, it's almost like the cynic calling. Like Epictetus talks about how, you know, we're not all cut out to be cynics, but some people are, because it's kind of all encompassing. And that's what the cynic is, right? The cynic is somebody who prioritizes the role of philosopher over family, over politics, over social. They actually have this kind of this singular role that subsumes the others. And I think we're a lot more sympathetic when that happens in other domains. Again, like the tortured artist, the painter, if that person is attached to what's up to them, if they've given up the other roles, if they've messed up their role hierarchy, but they're focused on what's up to them, which is like becoming the best at their craft and they love their craft, I think we're more sympathetic to that kind of paradigm. Do you share that intuition?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that connection to cynicism is a good one. It does seem like there are some people who violate ordinary common sense ethics. They don't follow through with some of their roles, but because they're so competent or so good at some other thing that mm-hmm. truly is valuable, it's difficult to say that they should have lived their life in another manner. Like, I suppose, you know, in some sense, of course, one should always be striving for virtue, and the fact that people, like say that in the artist's example, they fail in their familial obligations because they're so obsessed with their work. There's, of course, a sense in which it is true that they should have been a better father, mother, and so on. But one standing at making that claim certainly doesn't seem as strong. And I think it's almost like too utopian. It almost feels too, I'm not sure if that's right. I'm not sure if I believe that, but it may be wanting, maybe it is too utopian. I'm not sure if that's right.
Yeah, well, it makes me feel like, you know, everybody could always be better, right? So like, why can't you be this amazing artist and also, you know, nice to your kids? Like, it's like, mm-hmm. clearly that would be better, but we almost like forgive or excuse that when, as you said, it's valuable to the world. Yeah, maybe that's the part that I'm missing, is that it's valuable to the world. Not that it's the craft, it's that the craft is valuable to the world, because we also excuse people who are like that if they're trying to like cure cancer or something. And that's not in their control. That's clearly not up to them. But we still like because it's like ultimately helpful and beneficial, we kind of excuse that kind of ambition. Mm-hmm. And now, I mean, and now let's turn to, I have a Seneca quote here that I think we've just, in the moment come up with this idea of ambition. I mean, look, if you have ambition to be something that's bad, that's just bad. But even ambition for something that's good or worthwhile can be wrong if you start to pervert your role, or not pervert, is not the right word, but I guess distort the importance of that in relation to your other roles. You start forgetting to do your other relationships, the other things you have in your life. And I think the Seneca quote speaks to that. So Seneca says, quote, "They're lying, those people who want it to look as if the pressures of their job prevent them from engaging in liberal studies. It is all pretense, for they themselves keep adding to their activities. If they're busy, it's their own fault. I have time, Lucilius. I do have time. And wherever I am my own person. I do not give myself over to activities. I only lend myself." And I mean, Seneca, by all accounts, is a very, very successful person. And so there's this interesting idea there of and I'm sure he had a fair deal of ambition. And so assuming he's not lying or playing the character, it's interesting to see what he talks about like, I just lend myself to these activities, right? I don't lose myself in them. My identity does not become one-to-one correspondence with them, nor do the pressures of my job start to overtake my other roles. I lend a certain period of my time to those things, but I keep myself intact. And you can think of that either through the identity argument I was making earlier, or that as the kind of the other roles you have to play, the other parts of yourself.
Yeah, I sort of interpret that as saying these are people who overvalue some of their other roles at the expense of doing philosophy. Mm-hmm. And not philosophy in the academic sense, but philosophy of life and cultivating themselves and making that explicit choice. You know, if they are busy, it's their own fault to prioritize vacation, their office or other pursuits. Is that how you read it as well?
Yeah, I do. But I guess in Stoicism, like if you're not a Stoic, you could say there's certain kinds of people. This person's a philosopher. This person is a business person. This person is, they're a hedonist. They just like pleasure. But the Stoic is going to say, no, we're all the same kind of people, right? And so if you say, I don't have time to study philosophy, I'm too busy, you're wrong, and you're neglecting a part of yourself that's more important than the part of yourself that you're prioritizing. Mm-hmm. Objectively, the Stoics would say that. Not just different strokes for different folks, but like your ambition to succeed in business is harming your life because you're acting like you don't have time to do something which is more important than your business ambition. So yeah, I'm reading it the same way, but I guess I had that extra follow through.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a great point. Yeah, that's well added.
So I mean, I think what we come out of there is two types of bad ambition, or a similar way that ambition becomes bad, which is that, well, look, you want to be able to desire things, you want to be able to do things in the world. But if you desire them at the extent of, I guess, being a well-rounded person, and in a Stoic sense, being a well-rounded person means understanding your roles, your multiple roles, both as a rational being who should be caring about your character, who should be caring about, you know, how kind you are, how courageous you are, how just you are. If it comes, if your role of salesperson, entrepreneur, web athlete, artist, if that starts actually subsuming that and taking priority over that role of as a human being who's developing their character, well, then that's a negative type of ambition. That's a bad type of ambition. And mm-hmm. that's even not even considering the kind of cases. Well, I mean, they would all just be more extreme cases of that, the kind of cases where you're actually just ambitious for a bad thing and it makes you do bad things. I think the Stoic would say, well, look, if you were leading as a good person first, you wouldn't even pick that thing as the thing to have ambition for. You've only picked it as the thing you desire because you've lost yourself along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the point about losing yourself, I think, is key. Seneca has a line about the Roman Marius, which is Marius commanded armies, ambition Marius, which suggests that, you know, he had one when people, when they do become exceptionally ambitious, can lose that sense of who they are and are driven by some other force rather than themselves.
Yeah, so don't do that.
Yeah, don't do that.
That's bad.
Well, one other point on this front is that I think is useful to remember when you're reading, especially Seneca and Marcus Aurelius on ambition, is that the two of them were surrounded by the maybe like the top 1% of people in the Roman Empire who were ambitious. Like literally the most ambitious people in the world would be the people who Seneca and Marcus Aurelius would be interacting with on a daily basis. You know, generals, high-ranking politicians, aristocrats, and so on, who were looking to advance their station. So both in their personal lives, especially with Seneca, and in the lives of people who they would personally know, they would be very closely acquainted with the failures of ambition and probably have less of a sense of, you know, people who are not that ambitious, except for maybe there's some sense in which Nero could, I guess, be read as filling this bill. But I think that's important to keep in mind. You know, why do they hammer on ambition so much and maybe not people who lack drive? Because they see people who do terrible things, make terrible mistakes because of possessing too much ambition, perhaps.
Yeah, I love that point. It's always like a not too hot, not too cold kind of thing, right? So it's like, yeah, when you're surrounded by, like, you know, you're in the NFL and you're surrounded by people who have based their life around football, and you're like, hey, there's more to life than football. And like, you know, you start saying these things, hey, you know, you don't have to, maybe you could take a day off, maybe you could relax a bit. This is much different advice depending on who you're talking. Some people don't need to relax. Some people don't need to take a day off. Some people need a bit of a kick of motivation. But yeah, when you're in the court and you're seeing A, the most ambitious people in the world, and then B, the people who are suffering because of that, and you're seeing all the vices that come with that, that's a really great point. And it makes me think of, well, just makes me go back to Epictetus's line again, because Epictetus is tutoring these like really privileged, rich young men, right? And so he's like, hey, it's not a good argument. When you say I'm richer than you, therefore I'm better than you, that doesn't make any sense. Like, that's not, don't think that way. Oh, I'm more eloquent than you, therefore I'm better than you. Don't think that way. And he's talking to like these privileged 17-year-olds who are, you know, walking around being like, well, I was educated from a young age, so I'm better than all the other people in this town. And he's kind of just like pointing out how dumb that is and how that's not the right way to think about yourself and think about your self-development. So there's always this kind of, kind of audience in mind.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Good callback. All right. So let's move to the good form of ambition.
Yeah. Cool. So what is good ambition? I don't want us to think coming out of that, it's like Stoicism encourages passivity. I don't think it does. So a good Stoic life, it's not one without ambition. It's one where your ambition is correctly, I guess, has the correct target, I would argue. And so that correct target, obviously, the thing that you should have the most ambition towards, again, defining ambition as the thing that is difficult, wanting to do something that is difficult to do, wanting to do something that requires determination. The primary object of your ambition should always be your character, but it's okay to strive for that character and development with as much ambition as anything else. And so here's a quote from Epictetus that I really like that shows, I think, the importance of ambition. Epictetus says, "How much longer will you delay before you think yourself worthy of what is best and transgress in nothing the distinctions that reason imposes? And if you come up against anything that requires an effort or is pleasant, or glorious or inglorious, remember that this is the time of the contest, that the Olympic Games have now arrived. And even if you're not yet a Socrates, you ought to live like someone who in fact wishes to be a Socrates. And so this is a full endorsement of ambition, right? This is Epictetus saying, you should treat your life like you're preparing for the Olympic Games. You should aim to become Olympic champion. You should, even if you can't be Socrates, you should have the ambition to be Socrates. It's 100% endorsement of ambition. It's just ambition turned inward. It's ambition towards the development of our character. And I really like that. I really like that kind of role hierarchy idea we came up with earlier, right? And it's this idea of first things first. Have that ambition towards being a good person. That's ambition number one. And it's not easy come, easy go. It's not, you know, whatever happens, happens. Don't worry about it. Don't try hard. It is try hard. This matters. This moment, you know, when somebody insults you, when you have a chance to be kind to somebody, when you have a chance to show courage and discipline, this moment matters as much as the Olympic Games. You should have that degree of ambition, motivation, drive. It should just be directed inwards. It should be directed at your character and at your self-development. So that's point one. And for me, I think that's 90% of it. Good ambition just means shrinking what you're ambitious about away from the external and towards the internal. But, and then the other thing I would add, though, I think we nailed something today, Caleb, or we came up with something that's good, which is that really, as long as your other ambitions, as long as your desires to do difficult, hard things do not interfere with this primary ambition, I think it is fair game. So I think as long as you retain that hierarchy, then there's still a fair game to have ambition. Like, I think of myself in my own professional work. I care about my job. I want to do a good job. But I shouldn't want to do a good job at work more than I want to be a good person. Now I've messed up that kind of hierarchy of roles. And second, if there's ever a conflict between doing good at my job and being a good person, I should pick my character. I should prioritize that. But insofar as those two things are achieved, there's no real issue about taking a passion in your work. And I think back, like, if we pull it all the way back to the first quote, where that Reddit poster, you know, not to put too much pressure on them, they were making a post a couple of years ago, but they're talking about, you know, I go to work and I see people doing futile tasks, crawling over themselves, clamoring to suck up to the boss. I think you want to have ambition because your professional life, Stoicism teaches, is that it's not necessarily important. It's not the kind of thing you should ever compromise your character for, and you have important, meaningful things, even if your professional life is going poorly. I think sometimes people might find themselves in professional environments or environments where they're surrounded by ambitious people that are just things they don't like to do or are just things they don't care about. Mm-hmm. And if you don't genuinely like to do something or you don't genuinely think that it's important, well, then seeing other people trying really hard at it or seeing other people playing the game or having a lot of ambition in that area is always going to come off a bit gross. It's always going to come off a bit weird and misguided. So I think there's also something to be said there, which is like, look, obviously prioritize yourself. Don't ever compromise your character for your professional artistic ambitions. But, you know, if you don't like what you do, if you haven't picked a role for yourself that matches your inclination, your talents, your kind of the things that you like to do, well, then, you know, your ambition in that area isn't going to be fun either. But if you do have that, if you do find a job you like, a sport, a hobby, a passion, well, then I think your ambition is going to come quite easily, quite naturally. It's going to be quite pleasurable. It's going to produce a good thing, which is going to be, you know, a skill and maybe something good for other people. And there's no real conflict or issue there as long as it doesn't ever trump that primary goal or that primary ambition of character development.
Yeah, I thought that was really well put. I think it's clear that ambition matters for Stoics, and the primary desire in that full sense is to invest in being an excellent person. That's where, in a real sense, one's happiness lies for the Stoics. And then there's that question, how does that express itself? What does that look like in different lives? And whatever it is, it's doing your best in your relationships, career, projects, what have you. And I think that can really support healthy, ambitious lives where people live skillfully, acting in like truly impressive and admirable ways. So yeah, I think it was an inspiring reminder, really.
Yeah. So again, not too hot, not too cold, the kind of Goldilocks approach. You can't go too hot with trying to be a better person, the Stoics would say. As long as you're doing it in the right way, you can be misguided, you can get confused. But insofar as that's you can never be too ambitious there. And then when does it become too ambitious in the other areas? Well, when it starts to conflict with that, with your other roles, it starts to consume your identity to the expense of those other roles. And most importantly, that role of being a good person, because that's when the Stoics, we gave that torture artist example. Maybe you can be a bad parent. Maybe you can be a bad citizen. But I mean, it would be hard to be these things and not a bad person. But if you really become vicious, cruel, you know, if you really become a bad person, then it doesn't matter. On the Stoic account, it doesn't matter how good your art was or how much money you made. That, I think, is something we don't talk about. We talk about, you know, if you're a good person, it doesn't matter if you're poor, if you're on the torture rack. But the flip side to Stoicism is that if you're a bad person, not only subjectively will you be unhappy if you achieve your ambition, if you achieve that success. That's why you're a tortured artist in that example. But not only will you be unhappy achieving your ambition, but we also as people should judge you as a bad person, should say that was a bad life, even if you achieved your ambition, even if you were an excellent athlete, artist, you invented something, you started up you cured a disease, you started up a business, which is weird to say, but I think that's the flip side of the equation too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's really a good reminder, at least for me, that as a philosophical program, Stoicism is ambitious. It's saying, do your best in every endeavor you have, be an excellent person, and make sure you select the right roles and perform in those to the best degree that you can as well. And I think on one hand, that's an impossibly high standard. And on the other, it's, you know, something inspiring to shoot for. And it's worth remembering that Stoicism is always asking to perfect what's in your control. So in that sense, investing in externals, other markers of success in whatever pursuit you're engaged in is a mistake. You know, you're just called to do your best. That's ultimately what matters. And otherwise, let a fortune occur as it does.
Yeah, I'm also feeling pumped up. I think it's inspiring because it's like it's kind of robust. Like a lot of the inspirational things you see, it's kind of a motivational video. Somebody yells at you. There's a picture of a lion, and you know you feel strong for a moment, and then it kind of goes away. But this kind of ambition that's founded on genuine conviction about this as being the best way to live, and a kind of a system for being able to give yourself to something without losing yourself, which is give yourself as much as you can without compromising your other roles. That's something, it feels like I said robust, but it's the kind of thing that can stand up to the test. It's the kind of thing that you can base a life around in a good life. So yeah, we're both feeling motivated. At least I am, which is great. That's good for something that started off very anti-ambition.
Yeah, that's right. I think it could be useful to go back to the quote. And I think there are those two concerns. One, around, you know, watching other people scheming, plotting, straining, and sort of that human competition. The other was around more of this view from above type reasoning. You know, why have ambition at all if things will be wiped away in the end, if our concerns are so small? And I think we've adequately addressed that first one I just mentioned. But what do you think about the view from above? If you have any thoughts on that,
The view from above for me is you know, the Stoics never, the Stoics, we want to understand what's true. As humans, we have an inclination to distort what's true. So we have to introduce these cognitive exercises to pull our perception back towards the truth. And so again, that hot and cold, it's like, if the water's boiling, we got to pour some cold water in so we get room temperature. We don't want freezing water. We just pour some cold water in to get it to room temperature. And so we all have a tendency to take to be more dramatic than we need to be. We have a tendency to take things more seriously than they need to be. And I just always see the view from above as a mechanism of getting the correct amount of perspective. The room temperature water in this stretched out metaphor. You know, we don't do this exercise. You know, you could think of somebody who's like depressed, right? Somebody who's apathetic, and you might think of the opposite thing. You might grab them and shake them and be like, this is the only life you have. This moment matters. You know, what you do affects the people directly around you. You might do the opposite to kind of pull their attention into the moment, right? So I see the view from above as you said, Marcus Aurelius is like, he's in Roman court. He's everybody of the most ambitious people in the world. Everybody thinks the thing they're doing is the most important thing that could be possibly be done. That water is really hot. He's got to cool it down a bit. That's not necessarily the way you need to feel when you're like coming home to your family. That's not necessarily the way you need to feel when you go and you do your job and you provide a service that matters to people. You don't need to feel, well, these people will all be dead in 100 years. That's not necessarily the right tool for that moment. You know, so that's the way I feel about it. I think it's a good perspective for those that are too caught up. I think it's a bad perspective for those who aren't ambitious enough.
Yeah. I think that's well put. In our practice, we have the reminder to when you take the view from above, let the important remain and let the trivial fall away. So I suppose when you're doing this practice, it's key to have in sight what is concretely important in your life. You know, those relationships, your character decisions, and so on. And then, you know, with that in sight, you can maybe zoom out some. But if you're starting from a more nihilistic perspective, someone who's more depressed, shifting your perspective when you can't see what's in front of you to begin with is not may not be helpful.
Yeah, that's what I think. What about you?
Yeah. It might not be, if you're struggling from this sort of more nihilistic perspective, might not be the most useful reminder what we just said, but I hope some of those earlier thoughts about ambition and lines from Epictetus and so on were motivating.
Yeah, and I think there's something to be said for, we hit on this earlier, but Stoicism does want you to choose your roles, right? So what you're doing should be meaningful to you in some capacity. So maybe it's meaningful to you as a parent. You know, you don't really like your job, but there is some sort of meaning in providing for your family. Or maybe you do like your job and the meaning should be in the job itself. But I think if you find yourself in kind of an apathetic position, you want to kind of take that as evidence that maybe there's not a right. One reason that could be happening is there's not a right fit between who you are and what you're doing, right? And Stoicism teaches us a lot to kind of push through our perceptions of what we should be doing, our perceptions of the right way, societal, like, conceptions of the right way to live. I know this is vague. We don't know anything about this person, but I think that's something to be said too. I generally tend to think, and maybe you disagree, Caleb, but like, you know, I taught kids for a long time, and the kids will learn if they're engaged. They're engaged if they find it meaningful. So it's that question of like, how do you make what you're doing meaningful, and then not letting yourself feel that ambition that comes with that, you know?
Yeah, I think that's useful. I suppose you can break it down further and ask, like, what's the source of meaning? Some people, their source, they might be looking for an activity that feels meaningful because it brings some amount of social status or social approbation. And then maybe in that case, you might question that initial judgment. But in other cases, you might just get meaning from making daily progress. And I think sometimes you see, I've seen in my life, if you feel like you're not making any progress day to day, even in relatively mundane jobs or tasks, that can sort of suck away the meaning from whatever you're doing, if you feel like you're not improving. So that could, you know, that brings up the question, does that mean you need to completely think about a different project or what have you, again, speaking at these broad levels, or does that just mean you need to try something else, same project, different tactic? It's always hard to say at these levels, but I think,
Maybe we should do another episode. We should do one on apathy, maybe, or nihilism, or kind of, you know, take some time to think about how to confront that problem. If that's the problem that's occurring, not too much desire, but too little, not too much ambition, but too little.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, that's a good idea. Cool. Do you have anything else on this one?
No, that's it for me. Anything to add?
No, I think I'm good as well. Awesome. Thanks for putting this one together. This was fun.
Thanks, Caleb.
Thanks for listening to Stoic Conversations. Please give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and share it with a friend. If you want to dive deeper still, search Stoa in the App Store or Play Store for a complete app with routines, meditations, and lessons designed to help people become more stoic. And I'd also like to thank Michael Levy for graciously letting us use his music. You can find more of his work at ancientliar.com. And finally, please get in touch with us. Send a message to stoa@stoameditation.com if you ever have any feedback, questions, or recommendations. Until next time.